From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio, coming to you live from the studios of WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and on the internet at veteransradio.net. We welcome you to our program this morning, and as I mentioned earlier, we were having some problems with our website, so if you're looking to hear more about the generals, you're going to have to tune in a couple of weeks, because I think Bob's putting together another program for about some more generals, so we're excited about that. But today's program is going to be about World War One, and I can't wait to talk to our guest this morning is James Carl Nelson, who's the author of The Remains of Company D and also The Five Lieutenants, and talks about World War One, which to me, after I read these books, was just, I didn't realize how violent, how horrific World War One was. And I think it's going to be a great story. We're going to have him on in just a little while to talk about that. If you have any comments or questions that you'd like to ask us today, you can give us a call here at Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. It's 877-573-7825. Well, as you know, here on Veterans Radio, we like to talk about good things that corporations are doing for veterans. And I don't know about you, but I do like to eat, like most of us, and there is a special day coming up on Monday with an organization called Bob Evans Farms. And joining us on Veterans Radio right now is our guest, Margaret Standing.
Morning, Dale.
I wanted to welcome you to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So tell me all about Bob Evans. What are they doing on Monday?
Well, on Monday, this Monday, February 17th, we're proud to say that we're going to be celebrating President's Day with a special offer for veterans and also active military personnel. If you come on in with some identification, we'll be giving you free all-you-can-eat hotcakes all day long at our restaurants.
All-you-can-eat?
Yes, all-you-can-eat, so come hungry.
This could be really expensive for you folks.
Well, we're happy to do it.
I understand that you have done this in the past on other occasions.
That's correct. This year on Veterans Day, we actually had a similar offer of all-you-can-eat hotcakes. But because so many of our guests are veterans and active military personnel, and also just good patriots, you know, we found that it was so popular that we thought we'd extend it to other patriotic holidays. And so President's Day is our next opportunity to do that.
So, again, could you tell us, we're talking with Margaret Standing, what is your title there with Bob Evans?
I'm Director of Corporate Communications and Public Relations for Bob Evans Farms.
Well, you've done a great job, and we appreciate you sending us this press release. And I know it's been circulated around the country, so I'm hoping that all, what have we got, 500 and some odd Bob Evans restaurants in the country?
That's right, 561 restaurants in the country, and 51 of those right in Michigan, where you're broadcasting from.
I know. There's one just down the road. I can hardly wait. I think I'll go. Probably have to get in line on Monday just to get in. So, again, let's
well, who knows? We'll be happy to seat people as fast as we can. I know when I told my husband, who was in the reserves for many years, about this offer, he said, so I can go all day? He said, I'm going to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner there.
I know.
He said, as long as you eat hotcakes, we can help you.
I don't think that our doctors would be real happy if we ate hot dogs for 12 solid hours, although probably maybe 20 or 30 years ago I might have been able to do that. So to remind our audience out there, you can go to any Bob Evans anywhere across the country on Monday, February 17th. Just show some sort of valid military ID, and this could be your active duty ID. It could be your membership to the VFW, American Legion, probably your VA hospital card, anything along those lines. I don't think they'll probably give you too much of a problem there proving that you're a veteran, do you?
No, I don't think so. But if you do want to check, we've got a press release on our website that lists all the different kinds of proof that you can bring in, from your uniformed services identification card to your uniformed services retired identification card to current leave and earnings statements. Or if you come in wearing your uniform, that would work too.
I could come in wearing my uniform, but I don't think it would fit by the time I got done. Although I don't know if I can still get into the uniform anyway. But anyhow, thank you very much, Margaret. Again, we remind everybody out there, go to Bob Evans on Monday. All the hot take, hotcakes you can eat. Just bring along some identification that proves that you're either active duty or you're a veteran, and you can just sit there all day and regale people with your stories.
That's right, and people will love to hear about it.
I think they will, too. Thank you very much. This is such a great, great idea, Margaret, and we thank Bob Evans for doing this.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be with you today.
Okay, our pleasure. All right, folks, don't forget, Bob Evans, Monday. I don't know what time they open, probably pretty early, but I have a feeling that a few of you will be there. I know Bob is already planning on being there. He had mentioned that earlier in the day. So we're going to take a quick break right now, and we will be back with our guest. His name is James Carl Nelson. He's written a story about a couple of stories about World War I, the remains of Company D, and the five lieutenants. I encourage you to stay tuned to Veterans Radio and listen to this story and give us a call if you have a question at 877-573-7825. We'll be right back after this message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu. Or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Red, white, and blue, I am for you. Honest, you're a grand old flag. You're a grand old flag. You're a high-flying flag. And forever in peace may you wave. You're the emblem of the land I love, the home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats true under red, white, and blue, where there's never a ghost or brag. But should old acquaintance be forgot, keep your eye on that grand old flag.
And that, of course, was Jimmy Cagney with playing George M. Cohan with some of the great music of World War I. And it's what we're going to be talking about today. I think it's kind of one of those forgotten wars. It seems like it was so long ago that we don't know anything about it. But I think by the end of today's program, you're going to know much, much more about World War I and how important this was to the growth of America. And I think you're going to see I can't wait to talk about some of the characters that are in all these books. Our guest today on Veterans Radio is James Carl Nelson. He's the author of The Remains of Company D and The Five Lieutenants, both books about World War I. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest. Mr. Nelson was born to write, it says, The Remains of Company D, having been captivated at an early age by his grandfather's story of being wounded in France on July 19, 1918. He's an avid student of military history and author for years, and he was trying to figure out a way to tell his grandfather's story, and we'll get into that in a minute. But just also, I should point out that his grandfather was part of the 1st Division, and I believe that was the original Big Red One. So for all of you Big Red Ones out there, you can tune in right now. He spent over 7 years researching the lives of these people in the book. He's an author, native of Chicago, graduate of the School of Journalism, Mass Communications at the University of Minnesota. He's worked for the Miami Herald. Wow. Jim, you've done a lot here. Anyway, I want to welcome our author today. It's James Carl Nelson to Veterans Radio. Jim, welcome to Veterans Radio.
No, thanks very much for having me.
This story that you wrote is just fascinating, and I guess what we need to do is to get to the motivation of how you tried to put this story of the remains of Company D together.
Well, it began like you said that I grew up knowing two things about my paternal grandfather: one, that he was an immigrant from Sweden, and another, that he had been shot in France. And for a long time, I thought he had been with the Swedish Army, which of course, something of a non sequitur there, but over time, he didn't really talk about it much, but over time, small details emerged, this and that, and it wasn't until he died, he lived to be 101, 1993, and they had a memorial service for him. And some of the boys from the local VFW in Wisconsin, where he had moved to, sort of recounted, you know, what his where he'd been in France, these kind of things. And it struck me that, you know, there's some of the that he had been in at Cantini, which I knew something of. I knew there was a battle there that the 1st Division was involved in, but I didn't realize that he had been there. And so I just got, I don't know why, I just got obsessed with sort of following the whatever paper trail there was of his life, even though he was gone. And I contacted the 1st Division Museum in Wheaton, Illinois, and they sent me a muster roll. They said, can you find him on these rolls? I'm just looking, and there he was. But the thing that struck me was, it was about a couple pages of muster rolls from first was August 1st, 1918, and then subsequent months. And they had him listed there as missing since recent operations. And but so was almost everybody else, all these names I'd never heard or seen. And the motivation for the book right there was, in a bizarre moment, I just said, who were these guys and what happened to them? And how many lived, how many didn't? And I just started researching them, you know, even though they were all gone by then. Most of them had died. I think my grandfather might have lived the longest of anybody in the unit. So they started, you know, dying out in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. But, you know, I just kind of did what I could with the tools that we have these days to research fairly ordinary people who were in a remarkable situation in World War One.
Right, and we talk about this all the time when we talk to veterans about these just ordinary people who have, you know, been put in extraordinary circumstances, and somehow they always come out at, well, hopefully they all come out at the end. And their stories are fascinating to me, and your father being a Swedish immigrant, and, you know, they changed his name and all these different things that we, you know, we've only heard stories about. But these are actual real-life people. And it seems like a lot of the people that you talk about were from, what was it, Jamesville, Wisconsin?
Yeah. They had been with a company of the Wisconsin National Guard when the war broke out, or was it declared in April of 1917. They did it by locality, pretty much. So in that area, Janesville, Wisconsin, they joined up, then were transferred into the 128th Regiment of the 32nd Division, went over as a bunch, and when the 32nd Division got to France in like February, March of 1918, the division was basically broken up. Privates and officers were sent to the 1st Division to fill out its ranks, and the non-coms basically, and probably some privates too, it was going to be just like a feeder division, but it ultimately became a full-strength division itself, too, the 32nd, and they fought in some really hard-fought battles in the Argonne and central France. But so, yeah, so this group of about 30-some soldiers from Janesville area wound up being assigned to Company D as one, you know. So a lot of guys who knew each other there. And it made it, for me, it made it a lot easier to research because the Janesville Gazette followed these soldiers and wrote and published their letters. And so all the way from the beginning to the end, it helped my research immensely.
Well, I would think so. And I want to back up just a little bit. We're talking with James Carl Nelson, who's the author of Remains of Company D and the Five Lieutenants. We're going to talk about the Five Lieutenants later on. But I want to go back and kind of ask you to give us a little history lesson on how we got involved in World War One, because it's so convoluted somehow, you know, different treaties and so forth. As a result, you know, America did not want to get involved in World War One initially. Is that correct?
No, it did not. No, and it was seen as a, you know, a European war, as a war between these aging, you know, empires that really had nothing much to do with except supply with arms, you know, and make money of. But, you know, as I put in the book, it's, the fighting went on for 3 years, and we kind of just, there were elements here, Teddy Roosevelt and people like that, who wanted us to get involved in it, fight German imperialism and these kind of things. But Woodrow Wilson actually ran on the ticket of 1916 saying he would keep us out of war. And then, you know, not that much longer, a year later, he was asking Congress to declare war. We just kind of inexorably got drawn into it. even there was a mess, and everybody by then who could read a newspaper knew something of what the conditions were on the Western Front, certainly of just this stalemate of this trench warfare.
Mm-hmm.
It's just sort of like a magnet. You know, you just, I don't know. It's a lot of people still were against us getting involved. Wisconsin Senator Robert La Follette was a huge foe of getting in the war. But it just sort of, you know, the patriotism, the spirit, all this stuff just kind of brought us into it. And, of course, they were started to sink our ships, mm-hmm. our merchant ships and that. And of course, so that gave us an excuse, too. And what surprised me was just how many young men instantly just joined up as soon as war was declared, knowing what the conditions would be like. But that's that, you know, you don't really know what it's like. And it's like we're not gonna get stuck in that. You know, when they named John Pershing the commander of the AEF, you know, he was like, we're just going to break out of the trenches and go to Berlin. You know, we're going to do open warfare.
Right.
We had been trying that for 4 years.
We'd heard that one before. I'm interested when you were talking about, you know, I'm not the expert on this. I only read this great book, so I can talk about it a little bit. Is that the drafting, you know, they instituted a draft because they didn't have, I mean, they had people, you know, volunteering, but they still needed more men. So they reinstituted the draft for the first time since the Civil War, correct?
Right, yeah, exactly. And there were a lot of concerns about how that was going to go. But they set the date June 5th of 1917. Basically, anyone, I think the age was from 21 to 30, you had to show up to your local precinct draft board or whoever and register. And what's amazing is that it went without a hitch. And there was like 9 million men of that age showed up, including my grandfather, and registered for the draft. And there was no violence. There was not even really any protests or anything like that. So I think everybody's pretty amazed at the willingness with which most people registered. Although there were elements, of course, who did not believe in the war and resisted. And they're also what they called, I think the term actually originated then, was slackers.
Mm-hmm.
And those, they would round up, they'd find young men out on the street. The police would actually check them and round them up if they hadn't registered and throw them in jail. So it was a different era.
Like grown-up truant officers.
Yeah.
It sounds like. Well, the other thing that I was fascinated about is this microcosm of America at the time and the cross-section of these men that were, you know, had volunteered or were getting, you know, being called up from the draft, being from all different socioeconomic strata and from all over the world, it sounded like.
Well, you know, that since forever, you know, America had been a magnet for immigration, but it was at its height really in the 1880s to the turn of the century. My grandfather came over, he was 19 years old, he came over in 1911, and that was during that big flood from Europe, from all ports of Europe. And so, yeah, and most of them went to the cities, where there'd be opportunities and jobs. My grandfather went to Chicago. So, yeah, you found all these ethnicities living in all these ethnic neighborhoods at that time and filling out the ranks of America. And so, naturally, when it came time to find men to fight for America, certainly there were homebred Americans, but there were many, many immigrants. In fact, what occurred to me, it seemed to me during my research, was where a lot of Americans, small-town Americans, backwoods boys, you know, city boys, whatever, they enlisted fairly willingly right away. I think, you know, by and large, the immigrants were kind of not that they were unpatriotic or anything, but I think they were just waiting to be drafted more. They didn't have the urgency to return to Europe and get involved in that war. But when their number was called, they did, like my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
They'd come to America to make a new life. Why would they want to go back there and possibly die, you know?
Right, so, yes. We're talking with James Carl Nelson, who's the author of The Remains of Company D and The Five Lieutenants. And we're talking about World War One. If you have a question, give us a call at 877-573-7825. I think that what's fascinating to me is that the influx of all of these different men from all over the world and the training that was involved, and you mention in your book, you talk about some of the difficulties, especially with certain language barriers. of the commanding officers or the lieutenants trying to talk to the privates and so forth who really don't speak English that well.
Yeah, Richard Newhall in my book, Five Lieutenants, has this great anecdote about, you know, passing a message from Stanislavski to Tulowitz to whoever and seeing how garbled it was by the time it got down the little trench line there. But, yeah, but, you know, he also wrote that he had a certain Polish sergeant that it was very close to his heart and one of the best men he ever knew. But, yeah. The AEF, American Expeditionary Force, was actually largely comprised of immigrants from, you know, Italy, Sweden. A lot of Germans went back and fought their cousins.
Uh-huh.
And they actually, you know, they offered English training, these kinds of almost schools, you know, to get these. A lot of them didn't speak very good English. So it was something that was an element of the AEF, and I think, you know, the classic World War II, like, platoon story would always have an Irishman and an Italian
right.
and this and that and that, and I think that was even more so in World War One. Yeah.
Well, it certainly sounds like it, and let's go back into your book now, The Remains of Company D, and talk about, you know, we in the book you talk about their training and so on and so forth, and then how they get to France. And now they're there, and they're going to be going into their first conflict, and it's all this trench warfare. Could you describe trench warfare to our audience?
Well, basically, it began in the fall of 1914 when the Germans had invaded France, and then France obviously resisted, and then some major battles were fought, and slowly this line sort of stabilized, moving from the Marne to the North Sea in northern France, and just became static with that winter, and both sides dug in, and, you know, four-foot trenches filled with water, redoubts, misery, mud, rats, cold, but, they're just parallel trench lines, but then perpendicular trench lines for supply and this and that, and they periodically, when it became fighting season in the spring of 1915, both sides tried to, you know, launch offenses to move the others out, but it became a matter of gaining a few feet or, a few yards or 100 yards because there were secondary lines of trenches. So it just became the static line, really pretty much from the fall of 14 until the spring of 1918 when Americans started arriving in some force. And added a little bit to it, but also at that time the German army was suffering a lot from malnutrition, just the rate of that the soldiers had been dying, so the Germans were beginning to weaken a little bit, and so some movement was possible. But for 3 years, it was like no movement was possible, or at very high cost that really wasn't worth it.
I just think the conditions that these men lived in, I mean, you're living in this trench that you had to dig. You're digging a hole in the ground. And, of course, you know, it's going to be muddy and it's going to be smelly and it's going to be, you know, the food sounds like it was awful. But they just kept keeping on, it seemed like.
Yeah, Americans, like Men in Company D, when they arrived, they went into the trenches first in March of 1918. And got a little bit of a taste of what it was going to be like. Actually, some of them had gone to the trenches in November 17, but that was before the unit in the 1st Division was actually completely filled out. But so when they went into the trenches around Cantigny in late April, early May of 1918, they really got a taste of trench life. And yeah, and so they went in the trenches. They'd rotate in for about 10 days at a time. They had to have all their food brought up to them in, like, hot, you know, big bucket containers. They got it twice a day or water. But those were the carrying parties were the special targets of the German gunners. So, you know, to be in the carrying party was, like, the worst thing you could be. They'd have to bring it up through these perpendicular communication trenches or at night, but stay away from places that, you know, the Germans had certain areas just pinpointed, and they were just...
Mm-hmm.
Send barrages occasionally, just in case they could catch somebody in the open. So it was a real taste of what the British and French and Germans had been going through for years when they finally arrived. in their trenches themselves.
You talk in your book, The Remains of Company D, about the other countries' troops that were there, and you have Moroccans, you have French Foreign Legionnaires, you have all of this idealistic, I don't know what the term is I'm looking for here, but, you know, soldiers of fortune that are there also fighting.
And, right.
And, you know, that there weren't that many, it didn't sound like there were that many books that came out of World War One that actually told a story in the trenches about individual men.
Well, I think, you know, in Europe, on the British side, there definitely were, and in the German side, I mean, All Quiet on the Western Front, you know, tells from the German side. There's been a number of books, Robert Graves, Goodbye to All That, on the British side, some very good books about it. Not so much maybe from the American side, simply because the American experience in the war was brief compared to what the other countries were going through. I mean, really, you know, when 1st Division began its first major action on May 28, 1918, and the war ended November 11th, and they fought in four battles in that period. And then it was over, and then it was, like, forgotten almost right away, almost like nobody really wanted to hear about it. There's, you know, there's some magazines that I went through for research, and some of them were, you know, by the first of 1919, they were like, well, this is it. This is our last World War One story, or a great war story that we're going to be telling. It's just kind of like, let's just move on, everybody, you know.
Huh. That's interesting how that works. We're talking with James Carl Nelson, author of The Remains of Company D. So let's go in and start talking about some of these men inside of Company D. And let's start off with your grandfather. So tell me about what happened to him.
Well, he was, like I said, he's a Swedish immigrant. He registered for the draft, and he was called, I think, probably in July of 1917, and he had to report to Camp Grant, the new camp that they'd set up for draftees, pretty much in the Chicago area in northwest Illinois. And he trained at Camp Grant until the spring of 1918. I don't know exactly. I couldn't find him on a ship manifest. I don't know exactly when he went over, but he was certainly in France by May, and was a replacement for you know, one of those who, to back up. The 1st Division had gone into a battle at Cantigny, taken this village from May 28th to May 31st of 1918. They lost, the company lost about half of its strength, dead and wounded, 25 dead and 75, 80 wounded. So it needed replacements, as did all the companies in the 28th Regiment. So he was assigned to Company D of the 28th Regiment, 1st Division, and showed up on June 16th, company headquarters outside of Cantigny. The battle had been over, but he rotated in the trenches at least once between then and mid-July. And in mid-July, the 1st Division was moved to another area in the Compiègne Forest below Soissons, where a huge offensive was planned that involved the 1st Division, the 2nd Division, and the Moroccan Division, which included elements of the French Foreign Legion. And on July 18th, they jumped off, heading east towards the German lines below Soissons, made incredible gains the first day. I mean, for World War One, it was an incredible gain of, you know, 5-6 miles over this rolling countryside. But they were held up at the Paris-Soissons highway and dug in overnight. And Company D had been in the reserve the first day. They were the first battalion, so they were in reserve. The second day, towards the afternoon, they wanted to make a push, get across the road, and get to the ultimate objective, which was this village of Berzy-Lessec, which sat up in the highlands a little bit. And so the 1st Battalion was formed and sent east across the highway, and at some point, not too long, they jumped off about 5 o'clock in the evening, and within half an hour, my grandfather had been felled by a machine gun bullet. There was a very strong machine gun position just south of where the battalion attacked, and he, you know, true to form, he got shot in the left side, went in through his left side, nicked his spinal cord, came out the right side. Luckily, it came out, and he laid on the ground on the battlefield overnight and unconscious. And then in the morning, like he always described it as Algerian. They might have been some other West Senegalese or whatever, but from the Moroccan division, they were sent out, and they were walking around kicking guys to see if they were still alive, the wounded. And he groaned, and he got picked up, and they brought him to field station number 12 and, you know, went to triage, and they patched him up, and then they sent him to Paris, and he wound up in Red Cross Hospital number 1. And really, then, you know, eventually he was sent overseas back to America and then went through Fort Des Moines, Fort Lewis in Washington, and finally was discharged from Camp Grant on April 1st of 1919. So it was quite an odyssey from July 19th, 1918, when he was shot to when he was finally deemed okay and discharged. And he went on to live enough to be 101. So he always said that the doctors told him that only a tough Swede could have lived through what he was.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And, of course, he didn't want to talk about that. We're going to take a break right now. We're talking with James Carl Nelson, author of The Remains of Company D, First World War, and we're going to come back and talk about some of these individuals that you mentioned in that book. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back after this.
The Medal of Honor is the highest combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. First Lieutenant Deming Bronson was struck by an exploding enemy hand grenade, receiving deep cuts on his face and the back of his head, but continued to lead his men. Details after this.
There's always a moment of truth where I say, look, it's either put up or shut up. And it was time to put up. I had crossed that thin line. It was 100 plus degrees. We were hot. We were on fire. We were yelling our hearts out. You could feel the intensity rising. Even in our tiredness, even in our weakness, even in our pain, we continued to push. I told myself, you can suck up the pain for another mile and a half, and you will be a Marine. Not many people believe that I could do it. I don't know where I got the energy from. I don't know where the pain went to. But all I know is that I had what it took. I am a United States Marine.
AFC Darrell Willis proved he could be one of us. Can you? Call 1-800-MARINES. Maybe you could be one of the few and the proud.
Bronson, although injured, participated in the action that resulted in the capture of an enemy dugout with a great prisoner. On the afternoon of the same day, he was painfully wounded in the left arm by an enemy rifle bullet. And after receiving first aid treatment, he was directed to the rear. Disregarding these instructions, Bronson remained on duty with his company throughout the night, although suffering from severe pain and shock. The next morning, his regiment resumed its attack. Bronson's company was left in support of the attacking line. In spite of his wounds, he joined in the capture of the village. After the capture, he remained and participated in the capture of an enemy machine gun, he himself killing the enemy gunner. Shortly after this encounter, the company was forced to retire due to the heavy enemy artillery barrage. Bronson, who was the last man to leave the advanced position, was again wounded in both arms by an enemy high-explosive shell. He was then assisted to cover by another officer who applied first aid. Although bleeding profusely and faint from the loss of blood, Bronson remained with the survivors of the company throughout the night of the second day, refusing to go to the rear for treatment. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we are talking with James Carl Nelson, the author of The Remains of Company D. And it's a story of his grandfather's unit during World War One and the Battle of the Trenches in France. And unfortunately, Grandpa got shot, and it sounded like he didn't like to talk about his adventures in France much, did he?
Not very often. And it's one of those things, I think, you know, you leave alone and you let someone, if they want to talk about a traumatic experience, they'll talk about it and if they want to, but otherwise you don't really prod too much. And he didn't. He was, you know, taciturn, old school, old Swede anyway. He didn't really express himself a whole lot.
I'm related to some old Swedes, and they don't share a whole lot.
Yeah, so, Enough came out over the years, though, that I found out he was with the 1st Division, and it would happen that occurred at Soissons. One thing that struck me, too, was that I found out in my 20s, I sent this book on World War One to my grandfather, John Tolan's No Man's Land, and my grandmother wrote back and mentioned for the first time I found out that on July 19th, every year, they took that day to be with themselves and get away from the kids and just sort of, celebrate that he had lived. I think there's a term for that day. I don't know what it is. I saw a news report on it that continues that it's like a day of rebirth almost or something like that. That really struck me, too, that showed that he had some sentimentality, about his own life, or whatever. Yeah, he did not talk much about anything. So.
Right. Yes, if you'd like to get in on the conversation, give us a call here at Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. So let's take a look at some of these men that were involved in Company D, and I want to let our audience know that they can go to a website. It's called theremainsofcompanyd.com, and there's all these little biographies of these members of the company, and the pictures just... suddenly you understand how long ago this was.
Yeah, to look at those. So, when I first started, I didn't know if I was going to be able to, where this was going to lead. It was going to be a book or whatever. I was just passionately interested in it. And I picked a name off the roll that I thought was a little unusual, Rollin Lysak. And he was one of the Janesville boys. And I looked up some Lysaks in Janesville, Wisconsin. And the first one I called, I said, "Hey, do you know anything about this Rollin Lysak?" And he goes, "Oh, you mean Uncle Raleigh?" And it turned out that his sister had a whole box of letters, every letter that Rollin Lysak had written and that she had rescued from her grandfather's farm, his brother. And it was a fascinating tale right off the bat. He had, jumped off with my grandfather on July 19th across the Paris-Soissons Highway, and people saw him moving forward. Then someone saw him moving back over the line, back towards the aid station, and apparently he'd been shot. And he was sent to a hospital somewhere, maybe, but he just fell off the face of the earth after that. And his parents spent the rest of their lives trying to find out what had happened to their son. Just one of those strange tales almost in the, where it haunted them, and where his brother at one point thought he saw him on a train in Wisconsin. It just doesn't go away. You don't have closure. And right. I thought that was fascinating. The unit commander was a fascinating man. His name was Soren Sorensen. He was a Danish immigrant to Omaha and had actually been in the Army, joined in 1905, got out in 1909. Then he got a job working in the commissary at Alcatraz, which was a military brig at the time, and then joined up when war broke out, and was sent to officers training because of his previous military experience, and became the commander of Company D. I think he won the Distinguished Service Cross twice. Great natural leader, small guy. It's funny, there's pictures of him, tiny framed in that, but he survived the war. Was leading the 1st Battalion at the end of the war, and then was sent to be with the military police when they occupied Germany. And the division was just about to go home, and he was riding his motorcycle on June 1st, 1919, and it crashed it, and he died. So it was kind of a tragic end to this figure that captivated me.
There were so many interesting characters that were in this division, and some that went on to become famous in their own right. They became generals and congressmen.
Yeah, John Houston Church became a general in World War II. a long military career, definitely. In fact, he was in charge of ground forces in Korea when the North attacked in 1950.
That was Church?
John Church, right, yeah. Okay. And he was a second lieutenant with Company D, but he had also been... He was shot by a sniper at Soissons, almost right to his throat. Just missed it, and kind of nicked his throat. And so he was, he never really got over that wound from the gassings that the men underwent in World War One. His granddaughter told me that he was never really in robust health after World War One. He died fairly young, at age about 60, shortly after retiring in the early 50s.
I think it's fascinating when in reading this book, folks, when you read it, you're going to understand some of the traumatic things that happened to these men and women. Not the women, but they were nurses, but the men especially, from the gas attacks and all kinds of different gases that would, you know, almost make it impossible for people to breathe because it would burn your lungs from the inside out, especially the mustard gas. And that, you know, the innovation of the machine gun became much more prominent during World War One, and these guys would talk about the fear of just getting up to move from one point to another point because the machine guns always seemed to go off, and then the size of the artillery shells that were being fired at them, and they named them after trains.
And there's one description at the Battle Canteen. It's great. This guy Wes, what's his name? Welcome Waltz. He wrote a monograph after the war, and he described sitting in a hole, and he could see the shells are so big they're coming over. You could see them kind of lolling and tumbling in the air, and heading right for you.
I know. What do you?
And
what
he
do
says
you
it would hit near you, and it would suck all the air out, and you'd just be crumpled over. I can't even breathe, and it's just, oh my God.
I don't know how infantry survived. I mean, I was a pilot. I don't want to say I was above all this, but I was up in the air, and I didn't go through all of these things, and I just can't imagine being on the ground and seeing something coming at you that's, you know, 500 pound bomb, and you can just watch it fall on you.
Not only that, but the machine gun was really the most devastating weapon of that war. And they didn't really, they started to, but they didn't really have initially the tactics to overcome that. It was, you know, like, you know, the 1st Division's commanders would just send these guys basically in waves, like the other, you know, the commanders on all sides have been doing. They, you know, try to soften them up with the artillery, and then send them over across flat ground, which happened to my grandfather, you know, without even any really preparation. Artillery-wise, and it's just, you know, see those machine gun boys, that's where we're going. So, you know, it was just, and so they were willing those days to expend that number of lives, you know, to achieve victory, much more than we would today.
Well, I guess they just, you know, just figured the numbers into the whole thing and said, okay, if we can get 50% across, you know, the river, we'll be fine.
Yeah, I think for one of the 1st Division commanders, a famous quote was somebody questioned his men, and he said, "Sir, when there are only two men of my men remaining, they will be echeloned in depth and marching towards Berlin." So that was the attitude. Yeah.
I just think that's story. To our audience again, you've got to check out this book, The Remains of Company D, Story of the Great War, The War to End All Wars, and this is down in the trenches of what happened to these men. It wasn't just the officers in this case. You're talking individual stories, and through the private letters, I thought that was what was so fascinating to me, is you found all of this information about these soldiers through their letters.
Yeah, that was hit and miss. And, you know, of course, there was heavy censorship. You know, pretty much, you know, the average letter was, "How are you? I am fine. Can't talk about anything. Bye." You know, but I found there were differences to that. Number one, the lieutenants, the junior officers, they censored their men's letters, and they were supposed to censor their own, but in many cases they didn't. Mm-hmm. So they, early on, I found out that if you wanted to find out what was really going on, you know, you go to those letters, try to find those letters, and and that's where my book, The Five Lieutenants, came from, was just finding all this great, these caches of letters from the front back home that people had saved. And also an exception was when men were put in the hospital, it seemed to me, from what I could tell, that they were not having their letters censored anymore. Mm-hmm. There was nobody there to do it. And so I found some great stuff from, like, Willard Storms about the Battle of Soissons, just talking about the last charge towards Berzy-Lessec, which they took on July 21st, and just, you know, there was the remnants of the 1st Division at that point, and, you know, there was 600 men attacking, and within minutes, there were, you know, half of them were on the ground, you know. There's this great description, which was hard to come from. They weren't supposed to talk about where they had been, what actions they had been in, this kind of stuff. for fear that they'd have a unpublished or unsent letter on them that the Germans might find and get some intelligence from.
Wow. Well, this kind of gives us an opportunity to transition into your second book. So we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back, and we're going to talk about the five lieutenants. This is another fascinating story that was written by our guest today, Carl Nelson. And so you're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to Veterans Radio live from our flagship station, WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, Michigan, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, Florida, or listen online at AveMariaRadio.net.
The deal. You gonna get a job now or what?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org, brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we've been talking with James Carl Nelson, the author of The Remains of Company D. And now we're going to flip over to his newest book, The Five Lieutenants. And this kind of came out of the original story, The Remains of Company D, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. I was looking for anything I could find to sort of flesh out the Battle of Cantini, which I did three chapters on in The Remains of Company D. And I kind of stumbled across this story of Richard Newhall, who was he had been the Harvard PhD in history. He was with Company L of the 28th Regiment, one of my grandfathers with Company D, and George Haydock, who was also a lieutenant in Company L, and they had this amazing friendship. Some of Newhall's letters were collected into a book, a small academic house book, and told something of the story of that. And then I stumbled also across these letters from William Morgan, who was with the 3rd Machine Gun Battalion, also a Harvard boy. And George Redwood, who was Company I, the 28th, Baltimore man and a lieutenant, also a Harvard graduate. And then Alexander McKinlock, this fascinating story. He was served on the 2nd Brigade Staff. And they're all Harvard men. And they all left copious amounts of letters behind. I just put it together as they all knew each other, and so it was just a wonderful way to just tell in depth the experience of World War I as seen by an American officer from the American side in general that you don't usually see. And I think, you know, the depth, especially with Newhall's letters, the depth of honesty in what he was talking about, his always complaining. He's like, he would never belong to any club that would have him as a member. He's
just Groucho Marx thing.
You know, but of these five, not to give away the story, but they didn't all make it. But the central story within the story is this beautiful friendship that developed between Richard Newhall and George Haydock. Newhall writes about it, especially just, you know, he loves this man, and George does not make it, and he's just devastated. He has, George died at Cantini. He was in charge of the 1st Platoon, and Newhall had the 2nd. Mm-hmm. But Newhall, like my grandfather, was shot almost as soon as they jumped off at Cantini and laid out on the ground for 40 hours in agony. And he was shot several times by a sniper in the shoulders, the arm, and this and that, and was crippled for life in the left arm because of it. Then stumbled back, finally made his way back, was challenged when he got back to the trench line of Company L, and he was afraid he was going to get shot by his own men, but he made his back, and his first question was, did we take Cantini? And they said yes. And the second question was, what about Haydock? And they said, it's just as someone was telling me, you know, he was killed. He heard someone, another soldier, say, don't tell him. It was just like, because they knew he was going to be devastated by George's death. But it was just a vehicle to really get inside what was going on in World War One beyond all this censored, cleaned up type of material that has come out over the years.
Well, when you were writing the five lieutenants, and in there you talk about the don't know if it's the quality of the officer corps or just the officer corps in general, and kind of how they had to kind of pull this whole thing together in a short amount of time.
Right. Yeah. You know, they decided they wanted an army of 1 million men, and then they quickly decided they needed 2 million men, and then of course by the end of the war it was 4 million. So they needed someone to be able to handle these men and be able to train these men. And so, I mean, I don't know if it'd be much different now or what, but the obvious thought was, well, we should get, you know, men who have, you know, been to the universities. You know, they see them for, you know, if it's true or not, there's certainly, you know, more highly educated or whatever. And so, yeah, they solicited, the government actively recruited and solicited from the universities. Marine Corps did, too. It's funny, there was an instance of the Marine Corps went to the University of Minnesota in the spring of 1917, and like 500 guys joined as one.
Wow.
They wound up like in the same company. But, yeah, so they were looking at, you know, I don't know if it's elitist or what, but they were looking for educated men to come in. They'd be trained in these sort of 30-day wonder, they called it, World War II, six-week courses of government. Then many of them would in turn train other men. Mm-hmm. Well, some would be sent to France, and my five were sent to France and joined the 1st Division, which was, as you mentioned in the beginning, what is the origin of Big Red One? That was the 1st Division, yeah, at the time. It was actually, you know, actually created at the outbreak of World War One.
Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated with the idea of the different styles of leadership that these five and, you know, obviously many other, the young, especially the young officers, utilized to get their troops to do what they wanted to do.
Well, Newhall, you know, he was a little older. Newhall was about 29, and so he had a natural, a dominance over his men. But he was a bit firmer, but he knew what he was doing right when he started. I mean, there was no question about it. He was a very self-confident man. But you get to George Haydock, who was 23, and he's being put in charge of a platoon of 60 men, you know, half of them are immigrants. The other half, he called them, you know, these hardened Texas guys, you know. And some of them were regulars. They'd been in the Army already. And all of a sudden, he's got to figure out how to order them around and have them follow his orders without laughing at them. And Five Lieutenants describes his struggles of just like, God, I can't cope. I can't handle this. I don't know what I'm doing. And they're laughing at me. But ultimately, you know, he learned to just, you know, let my men talk. You know, he has a great instance where he matured very much as a leader. He got his men's respect by the way he led them in the trenches at Seicheprey in March of 1918. The book does talk about that, because you imagine yourself, you're 23 years old, you just got out of college, and you're carefree and young and all this, and you know nothing of the world, really, and all of a sudden you're in France leading men through the trenches, you know. That would test your abilities real quick.
I would think so. We've talked to a lot of officers in the various branches of the military here on Veterans Radio, and they all talk about their first experiences when they were, you know, a young ensign or a second lieutenant, and how nervous they were. You know, they were confident, but the idea is they had to win over these hardened veterans who, you know, every time they see a young officer come in, they're going, oh, here we go again. And, you know,
exactly.
Have to kind of start over, all over.
Yeah.
I think that's a great story that you tell in here in the Five Lieutenants, and the idea that they would sit around and talk, you know, world literature and so forth versus probably what the conversations of some of the lower-ranking soldiers that they had with them would be talking about.
Yeah, it's funny, and I like that clash too, especially the being Harvard boys and sort of, you know, so overeducated or whatever. But it's like Newhall, PhD in history, and he has this great anecdote. They pulled the 28th Infantry out of the trenches to send them back some miles before Cantigny, and that they trained over the similar ground that they were going to advance over a few days afterwards. And he's standing there while this thing's going on, this maneuver, and he says he ran all the lines from the opera Aida through his head. That's how he kept his mind occupied. I mean, you wouldn't get that from the average soldier. You know?
No, you would be, you know, singing Mademoiselle from Armand.
But I like that. I like the contrast between that, the cultures. You know what I mean? The educated versus the average American guy or whatever, you know. So and that, the clash of cultures there, you know.
Right, but I think that that's what's so interesting to me is about this clash of cultures and how they became more of a, you know, they became this team that was successful.
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely. Everybody, you know, came together. And the men admired their leaders, you know, in Newhall and Haydock. And George Redwood was just a natural. He was he became a battalion scout, and so he became a legend. He'd go out on scouting missions every night to the German lines. He'd bring back sausages and bread and wine. And he was with the team that captured the first first German prisoners at Seicheprey. Mm-hmm. You know, he was just fearless, but really very intelligent and able. He was killed at Cantina, too, unfortunately.
Well, you know, the idealism of that time period of going into the 20s, and we, you know, we read about these things with Fitzgerald and all of the different authors of that time and the loss of innocence. And I think that both of your books talk about that, I think, in great detail. And it's a great learning experience for people that want to know why great-grandfather or grandpa was the way that he was, or why that generation, you know, was so anxious to put that whole experience behind them.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, I would say, though, overall, that the descendants I talked to, like, from those who were in Company D or the five lieutenants, they said that, you know, they're forebears remained very proud of their service, you know, even though they didn't talk about it much. They were proud of it, proud of having done, even, you know, considering in terms of the fact that World War One didn't really settle everything fine, right, with any great finality because, you know, it had to be settled in World War Two. But they remained very proud. And they, of course, sent their sons into World War Two. Mm-hmm. So, you know, although they were affected, maybe disaffected by the outcome that they hadn't settled anything, they still, there's that military service part of it. You know, they were very pleased that they had done their bit, you know.
Yeah, I think a lot of veterans feel that way, you know. If you know, if you don't solve the issue of whatever it was, though, what you did while you were there, you know, that's the best that you can do.
It's like I handled myself as the best I could. I did it the best I could, and I'm happy with that. Yeah, you know.
Right. So we've been talking with James Carl Nelson today here on Veterans Radio. He's the author of The Remains of Company D and The Five Lieutenants. Tell our audience where they can get these books, please.
Oh, these books are available, you know, Amazon, any online source, maybe Barnes & Noble. Bricks and mortar wise, all sorts of places. You know, Remains came out in the fall of 2009, so it's been out for a while, and Five Lieutenants came out in November of 2012. But yeah, certainly you can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any big, you know, place and order it.
We will do that. And also I could recommend to people, they can go to the veteransradiobookstore.com, and the books are listed there, and they can purchase them through there, and, you know, we can make a couple of pennies off of that. James Carl Nelson, I want to thank you very, very much for being on Veterans Radio today.
No, thank you very much for having me.
And we'll be talking to you again. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Wow, what a great story, folks. I strongly encourage you to go out to get these two books and to tune in next week to Veterans Radio. So until then, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.